healthy. Some gabbed on cell phones and constantly fiddled with handheld electronics of one kind or another, experiencing a bit of the bends after spending all week immersed in their work. Why did I go to the police? I have been told countless times since that terrible day that I am not to blame for what happened. On one level, I realized that my actions may have changed nothing. In all likelihood, they had never intended to let Tara come home. She might even have been dead before the first ransom call. Her death may have been accidental. Maybe they just panicked or were strung out. Who knows? I certainly don't. And, there's the rub. I cannot, of course, be certain that I am not responsible. Basic science. For every action, there is a reaction. I do not dream about Tara. Or if I do, the gods are generous enough to not let me remember. That is probably giving them too much credit. Let me rephrase. I may not dream about Tara specifically, but I do dream about the white van with the mix-and-match license plate and the stolen magnetic sign. In the dreams, I hear a noise, muffled, but I'm pretty sure it is the sound of a baby crying. Tara, I know now, was in the van, but in my dream, I don't move toward the sound. My legs are buried deep in that nightmare muck. I can't move. When I finally wake up, I cannot help but ponder the obvious. Was Tara that close to me? And more important, had I been a little braver, could I have saved her then and there? The referee, a lanky high school boy with a good-natured grin, blew the whistle and waved his hands over his head. Game over. Lenny shouted, "Woo yeah!" The 8-year-olds stared at one another, confused. One asked a teammate, "Who won?" And the teammate shrugged. They lined up, Stanley Cup hockey style, for the post-game handshakes. Cheryl stood up and put a hand on my back. "Great win, coach." "Yeah, I carry this team," I said. She smiled. The boys started rambling back toward us. I congratulated them with my stoic nod. Craig's mother had brought a 50-pack of Dunkin' Donut Munchkins in a box with a Halloween design. Dave's mom had boxes of something called Yoo-Hoo, a perverse excuse for chocolate milk that tastes like chalk. I popped a munchkin in my mouth and skipped the washdown. Cheryl asked, "What flavor was that?" I shrugged. "They come in different flavors?" I watched the parents interact with their children and felt tremendously out of place. Lenny came toward me. "Great win, wasn't it?" "Yeah," I said. "We're the balls." He gestured for us to step away. I complied. When we were out of earshot, Lenny said, "Monica's estate is almost wrapped up. It shouldn't be too much longer now." I said, "Uh-huh," because I didn't really care. "I also have your will drawn up. You need to sign it." Neither Monica nor I had made up a will. For years, Lenny had warned me about that. "You need to put in writing who gets your money," he'd remind me. "Who is going to raise your daughter? Who is going to care for your parents?" Yada, yada, yada. But we didn't listen. We were going to live forever. Last wills and testaments were for, well, the dead. Lenny changed subjects on the fly. "You want to come back to the house for a game of foosball?" Foosball, for those of you who lack a basic education, is that tabletop bar game with soccer-type men skewered on sticks. "I am already champion of the world," I reminded him. "That was yesterday." "Can't a man revel in his title for a little while? I'm not yet ready to let go of the feeling." "Understood." Lenny headed back to his family. I watched his daughter Marianne corner him. She was gesturing like mad. Lenny slumped his shoulders, took out his wallet, peeled out a bill. Marianne took it, kissed him on the cheek, ran off. Lenny watched her disappear, shaking his head. There was a smile on his face. I turned away. The worst part, or should I say the best part, was that I have hope. Here was what we found that night at Grandpa's cabin. My sister's corpse, hairs belonging to Tara in the pack and play, DNA confirmed, and a pink one-piece with black penguins that matched Tara's. Here was what we did not find, and in fact still have not found. The ransom money, the identity, if any, of Stacy's accomplices, and Tara. That's right. We never found my daughter. The forest is big and sprawling, I know. The grave would be small and easily hidden. There could be rocks over it. An animal might have found it and dragged the contents deeper into the thicket. The contents could be miles from my grandfather's cabin. They could be somewhere else entirely. Or, though I keep this thought to myself, maybe there is no grave at all. So you see, the hope is there. Like grief, hope hides and pounces and taunts and never leaves. I am not sure which of the two is the crueler mistress. The police and FBI theorize that my sister acted in conjunction with some very bad people. While no one is quite sure if their original intention was kidnapping or robbery, most everyone agrees that someone panicked. Maybe they thought that Monica and I would not be home. Maybe they thought that they would just have to contend with a babysitter. Whatever. They saw us, and acting in some drugged or crazed state, someone fired a shot. Then someone else fired a shot, ergo the ballistic tests showing Monica and I were shot by different 38s. They then kidnapped the baby. Eventually, they double-crossed Stacy and killed her with an overdose of heroin. I keep saying they because the authorities also believe that Stacy had at least two accomplices. One would be the professional, the cool head who knew how to work the drop and weld the license plates and disappear without a trace. The other accomplice would be the panicker, if you will, the one who shot us and probably caused the death of Tara. Some, of course, don't buy that theory. Some believe that there was only one accomplice, the cool professional, and that the one who panicked was Stacy. She, this theory goes, was the one who fired the first bullet, probably at me since I don't remember any shots, and then the professional killed Monica to cover the mistake. This theory is backed up by one of the few leads we had following that night in the cabin. A drug dealer who, in some bizarre plea bargain on another charge, told authorities that Stacy had purchased a gun from him, a 38, a week before the murder kidnapping. This theory is further backed up by the fact that the only unexplained hairs and fingerprints found at the murder scene were Stacy's. While the cool pro would know to wear gloves and be careful, a drugged-out accomplice would probably not. Still others do not embrace that theory either, which is why certain members of the police department and FBI cling to and support a more obvious third scenario. I was the mastermind. The theory goes something like this. First caveat, the husband is always suspect number one. Second, my Smith & Wesson 38 is still missing. They press me on this question all the time. I wish I had an answer. Third, I never wanted a child. Tara's birth forced me into a loveless marriage. They believe that they have evidence that I was considering divorce. Something that, yes, I did indeed contemplate. And so I planned the whole thing top to bottom. I invited my sister over to my house and perhaps enlisted her help so that she would take the fall. I have the ransom money hidden away. I killed and buried my own daughter. Awful, yes, but I am past anger. I am past exhaustion. I am not sure where I am anymore. The main problem with their hypothesis is, of course, that it is hard to finesse my being left for dead. Did I kill Stacy? Did she shoot me? Or, drumroll here, is there a third possibility out there, a blending of the two different theories into one? Some believe that yes, I was behind it, but I had another accomplice besides Stacy. That accomplice killed Stacy, perhaps against my wishes, perhaps as part of my grand scheme to deflect my guilt and avenge my own shooting. Or something like that. And round we go. In sum, when you cut through it all, they, and I, have nothing. No ransom money. No idea who did it. No idea why. And most important, no small corpse. That is where we are today, a year and a half after the abduction. The file is still technically open, but Regan and Tickner have moved on to new cases. I haven't heard a word from either in nearly 6 months. The media gnawed on us for a few weeks, but with nothing new to feed on, they too slithered toward juicier troughs. The Dunkin' Donuts munchkins were gone. Everyone started heading to a parking lot overloaded with minivans. After the game, we coaches take our budding athletes to Schraft's Ice Cream Parlor, a tradition in our town. Every coach in every other league and every other age group follows the same tradition. The place was packed. Nothing like an ice cream cone in the autumn frost to burrow the chill into the bone. I stood with my cookies and cream cone and surveyed the scene. Children and fathers. It was getting to be too much for me. I checked my watch. Time for me to leave anyway. I met Lenny's eye and motioned that I was going. He mouthed the words, "Your will," at me. In case I didn't get the drift, he even made a signing motion with his hand. I waved that I understood. I got back into my car and flipped on the radio. For a long while, I sat there and watched the flow of families. I kept my eyes on the fathers, mostly. I gauged their reactions to this most domestic of activities, hoping to see a flicker of doubt, something in the eyes that might comfort me. But I didn't. I'm not sure how long I stayed like that. Not more than 10 minutes, I suppose. An old favorite by James Taylor came on the radio. It brought me back. I smiled, started up the car, and made my way toward the hospital. An hour later, I was scrubbing up to perform surgery on an 8-year-old boy with, to use terminology familiar to both layman and professional, a facial smash. Zia LaRue, my medical partner, was there. I'm not sure why I first chose to be a plastic surgeon. It was neither the siren song of easy dollars nor the ideal of helping my fellow man. I had wanted to be a surgeon pretty much from the get-go, but I saw myself more in the vascular or cardiac fields. Life's turns come in funny ways, though. During my second year of residency, the cardiac surgeon who ran our rotation was, what's the phrase? A total prick. On the other hand, the doctor in charge of the cosmetic surgery, Liam Reese, was incredible. Dr. Reese had that enviable, have-it-all feel to him, that combination of good looks, calm confidence, and internal warmth that naturally drew people. You wanted to please him. You wanted to be like him. Dr. Reese became my mentor. He showed how reconstructive surgery was creative, A Humpty Dumpty process that forced you to find new ways to put back together what had been destroyed. The bones in the face and skull are the most complex stretch of skeletal landscape in the human body. We who repair them are artists. We are jazz musicians. If you talk to orthopedic or thoracic surgeons, they can be pretty specific about their procedures. Our work, reconstruction, is never exactly the same. We improvise. Dr. Reese taught me that. He appealed to my inner techno-weenie with talk of microsurgery and bone grafts and synthetic skin. I remember visiting him in Scarsdale. His wife was long-legged and beautiful. His daughter was school valedictorian. His son was captain of the basketball team and the nicest kid I've ever met. At the age of 49, Dr. Reese was killed in a car crash on Route 684 heading to Connecticut. Somebody might find something poignant in that, but that person wouldn't be me. When I was finishing up residency, I landed a one-year fellowship to train in oral surgery overseas. I didn't apply to be a do-gooder. I applied because it sounded pretty cool. This trip would be, I hoped, my version of backpacking through Europe. It was not. Things went wrong right away. We got caught up in a civil war in Sierra Leone. I handled wounds so horrible, so unfathomable, that it was hard to believe the human mind could conjure up the necessary cruelty to inflict them. But even in the midst of this destruction, I felt a strange exhilaration. I don't try to figure out why. Like I said before, this stuff gets me jazzed. Maybe part of it was the satisfaction of helping people truly in need. Or maybe I was drawn to this work the same way some are drawn to extreme sports, who need the risk of death to feel whole. When I came back, Zia and I set up One World, and we were on our way. I love what I do. Perhaps our work is like an extreme sport, but it also has a very, pardon the pun, human face. I like that. I love my patients, and yet I love the calculating distance, the necessary coldness of what I do. I care about my patients so much, but then they are gone. Intense love mixed with fleeting commitment. Today's patient presented us with a rather complicated challenge. My patron saint, the patron saint of many in reconstructive surgery, is the French researcher René Lefort. Lefort tossed cadavers off a tavern roof onto their skulls to see the natural pattern of fracture lines in the face. I bet this impressed the ladies. His experiments also included dropping increasingly heavy weights on cadaver skulls to measure how severe the injuries to the maxilla. Today we name certain fractures for him. More specifically, Lefort type 1, Lefort type 2, Lefort type 3. Zia and I checked the films again. The water view gave us the best look, but the Caldwell and lateral backed it up. Simply put, the fracture line on this 8-year-old was a Lefort type 3, causing a complete separation of the facial bones and the cranium. I could pretty much rip off the boy's face like a mask if I wanted to. "Car accident?" I asked. Zia nodded. "Father was drunk." "Don't tell me. He's fine, right?" "He even remembered to put on his own seatbelt." "But not his son's." "Too much trouble. What with him being tired from raising a glass so many times." Zia and I started our life's journey in two very different places. Like the story's classic 70s song, Brother Louie, Zia is black as the night while I am whiter than white. My skin tone, as described by Zia, underwater fish belly. I was born at Beth Israel Hospital in Newark and grew up on the suburban streets of Caselton, New Jersey. Zia was born in a mud hut in a village outside of Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Sometime during the reign of Papa Doc, her parents became political prisoners. No one knows too many details. Her father was executed. Her mother, when released, was damaged goods. She grabbed her daughter and escaped on what might liberally be dubbed a raft. 3 passengers died on the journey. Zia and her mother survived. They made their way to the Bronx, where they took up residence in the basement of a beauty parlor. The 2 spent their days quietly sweeping hair. The hair, it seemed to Zia, was inescapable. It was on her clothes, clinging to her skin, in her throat, in her lungs. She lived forever with that feeling that a stray strand was in her mouth and she couldn't quite pull it out. To this day, when Zia gets nervous, her fingers play with her tongue as though trying to pluck out a memento of her past. When the surgery was over, Zia and I collapsed onto a bench. Zia untied her surgical mask and let it fall to her chest. "Piece of cake," she said. "Amen," I agreed. "How did your date go last night?" "It sucked," she said. "And I don't mean that literally." "Sorry. Men are such scum. Don't I know it." "I'm getting so desperate," she said, "I'm thinking of sleeping with you again." "Gasp," I said. "Woman, have you no standards?" Her smile was blinding, the bright white against the dark skin. She was a shade under 6 feet tall, with smooth muscles and cheekbones so high and sharp you feared they might pierce her skin. "When are you going to start dating?" she asked. "I date. I mean long enough to have a sexual encounter." "Not all women are easy as you, Zia." "Sad," she said, giving my arm a playful punch. Zia and I slept together once, and we both knew that it would never happen again. It was how we met. We hooked up during my first year of medical school. Yep. A one-night stand. I've had my fair share of one-night stands, but only 2 have been memorable. The first led to disaster. The second, this one, led to a relationship I will cherish forever. It was 8 o'clock at night by the time we got out of our scrubs. We took Zia's car, a tiny thing called a BMW Mini, to the Stop and Shop on Northwood Avenue and picked up some groceries. Zia chatted without let-up as we wheeled carts down the aisles. I liked when Zia talked. It gave me energy. At the deli counter, Zia pulled a call number. She looked at the specials board and frowned. "What?" I said. "Boar's head ham on sale." "What about it?" "Boar's head," she repeated. "What marketing genius came up with that name? Say, I have an idea. Let's name our premium cold cuts after the most disgusting animal imaginable. No, check that. Let's name it after its head." "You always order it," I said. She thought about it. "Yeah, I guess." We moved to the checkout line. Zia put her stuff up front. I placed the divider down and unloaded my cart. A portly cashier began to ring up her items. "You hungry?" she asked me. I shrugged. "Guess I could go for a couple of slices at Garbo's." "Let's do it." Zia's eyes drifted over my shoulder and then jerked to a stop. She squinted and something crossed her face. "Mark?" "Yeah." She waved it off. "Nah, can't be." "What?" Still staring over my shoulder, Zia gestured with her chin. I turned slowly, and when I saw her, I felt it in my chest. "I've only seen her in pictures," Zia said. "But isn't that..." I managed to nod. It was Rachel. The world closed in around me. It shouldn't feel this way. I knew that. We had broken up years ago. Now, after all this time, I should be smiling. I should feel something wistful, a passing nostalgia, a poignant remembrance of a time when I was young and naive. But no, that was not what was going on here. Rachel stood 10 yards away, and it all flooded back. What I felt was a still too powerful yearning, a longing that tore through me, that made both the love and heartbreak feel fresh and alive. "You okay?" Zia said. Another nod. "Are you one of those who believe that we all have one true soulmate? One and only one preordained love?" There, across 3 Stop-and-Shop checkout lanes and under a sign reading Express Lane, 15 items or less, stood mine. Zia said, "I thought she got married." "She did," I said. "No ring." Then Zia punched my arm. "Ooh, this is exciting, isn't it?" "Yeah," I said. "Exhilaration City." Zia snapped her fingers. "Hey, you know what this is like? That crappy old album you used to play. The song about meeting the old lover in the grocery store. What's the name of it?" The first time I'd seen Rachel when I was a lad of 19 years, the effect was relatively gentle. There was no big boom. I'm not even sure that I found her overly attractive. But as I'd soon learn, I like a woman whose looks grow on you. You start off thinking, okay, she's pretty decent looking, and then a few days later, maybe it's something she says, the way she tilts her head when she says it, but then, wham! It's like getting hit by a bus. It felt like that again now. Rachel had changed, but not by much. The years had made that sneaky beauty harden, maybe, more brittle and angled. She was thinner. Her dark blue-black hair was pulled back and tied into a ponytail. Most men like the hair down. I've always liked it tied back, the openness and exposure of it, I guess, especially with Rachel's cheekbones and neck. She wore jeans and a gray blouse. Her hazel eyes were down, her head bent in that pose of concentration I knew so well. She had not seen me yet. "Same old Lang Syne," Zia said. "What?" "The song about the lovers and the grocery store, by Dan somebody. That's the title, Same Old Lang Syne." Then she added, "I think that's the title." Rachel reached into her wallet and plucked out a 20. She began to hand it to the cashier. Her gaze lifted, and that was when she saw me. I can't say exactly what crossed her face. She did not look surprised. Our eyes met, but I did not see joy there. Fear, perhaps. Maybe resignation. I don't know. I also don't know how long we both stood there like that. "Maybe I should move away from you," Zia whispered. "Huh?" "If she thinks you're with a chick this hot, she'll conclude that she has no chance." I think I smiled. "Mark?" "Yeah." "The way you're standing like that, gaping, like a total whack job. It's a little scary." "Thanks." I felt her hand push on my back. "Go over and say hello." My feet started moving, though. I don't remember the brain issuing any commands. Rachel let the cashier bag her groceries. She stepped toward me and tried to smile. Her smile had always been spectacular, the kind that makes you think of poetry and spring showers, a dazzler that can change your day. This smile, however, was not like that. It was tighter. It was pained. And I wondered if she was holding back or if she could no longer smile like she used to, if something had dimmed the wattage permanently. We stopped a yard away from each other, neither sure if the proper protocol called for a hug, a kiss, a handshake. So we did none of the above. I stood there and felt the hurt everywhere. "Hi," I said. "Good to see you still have all the smooth lines," Rachel replied. I feigned a rakish grin. "Hey, baby, what's your sign?" "Better," she said. "Come here often?" "Good. Now say, haven't we met before?"
"Nah."
I arched an eyebrow. "No way I'd forget meeting a foxy lady like you." We both laughed. We were both trying too hard. We both knew it. "You look good," I said. "So do you." Brief silence. "Okay," I said, "I'm out of uncomfortable cliches and forced banter." "Phew," Rachel said. "Why are you here?" "I'm buying food." "No, I mean, I know what you meant," she interrupted. "My mother moved into a condo development in West Orange." A few of the strands had escaped her ponytail and fell across her face. It took all my willpower to stop from pushing them away. Rachel glanced away and then back at me. "I heard about your wife and daughter," she said. "I'm sorry." "Thank you." "I wanted to call or write, but..." "I heard you got married," I said. She wiggled the fingers on her left hand. "Not anymore." "And that you were an agent with the FBI. Rachel put her hand back down. "Also not anymore." More silence. Again, I don't know how long we stood there. The cashier had moved on to the next shopper. Zia came up behind us. She cleared her throat and jammed her hand toward Rachel. "Hi, I'm Zia LaRue," she said. "Rachel Mills." "Good to meet you, Rachel. I'm Mark's practice partner." Then, thinking about it, she added, "We're just friends." "Zia," I said. "Oh, right, sorry. Look, Rachel, I'd love to stay and chat, but I have to run." She jerked her thumb toward the exit to emphasize the point. "You two talk. Mark, I'll meet you back here later. Great meeting you, Rachel." "Same here." Zia rushed off. I shrugged. "She's a great doctor."
"I bet she is."
Rachel took hold of her cart.
"I have someone waiting in the car, Mark. It was good seeing you."
"You too." But surely with all I'd lost, I must have learned something, right? I couldn't just let her go. I cleared my throat and said, "Maybe we should get together."
"I'm still living in Washington. I head back tomorrow."
Silence. My insides turned to jelly. My breathing was shallow.
"Goodbye, Mark," Rachel said.
But those hazel eyes were wet.
"Don't go yet."
I tried to keep the pleading out of my voice, but I don't think I was successful. Rachel looked at me and she saw everything.
"What do you want me to say here, Mark?"
"That you want to get together too."
"That's all?"
I shook my head. "You know that's not all."
"I'm not 21 anymore."
"Neither am I."
"The girl you loved is dead and gone."
"No," I said. "She's right in front of me."
"You don't know me anymore."
"So let's get reacquainted. I'm not in a rush."
"Just like that?"
I tried to smile.
"Yeah."
"I live in Washington. You live in New Jersey."
"So I'll move," I said.
But even before the impetuous words came out,
Even before Rachel made that face, I could recognize my own false bravado. I couldn't just leave my parents, or dump my business with Zia, or abandon my ghosts. Somewhere between my lips and her ears, the sentiment crashed and burned. Rachel turned to leave then. She did not say goodbye again. I watched her push the cart toward the door. I saw it automatically swing open with an electric grunt. I saw Rachel, the love of my life, disappear again without so much as a backward glance. I stayed still. I did not follow her. I felt my heart tumble and shatter, but I did nothing to stop her. Maybe I hadn't learned anything after all. Chapter 9. I drank. I am not a big drinker. Pot had been my elixir of choice during my younger days, but I found an old bottle of gin in a cabinet over the sink. There was tonic in the fridge. I have an automatic ice maker in the freezer. You do the math. I still lived in the old Levinsky house. It is much too big for me, but I don't have the heart to let it go. It feels like a portal now, a lifeline, albeit fragile one, to my daughter. Yes, I know how that sounds, but selling it now would be like closing a door on her. I can't do that. Zia wanted to stay with me, but I begged off. She did not push it. I thought about the corny Dan Fogelberg, not Dan somebody, song where the old lovers talk until their tongues get tired. I thought about Bogey questioning the gods who would allow Ingrid Bergman into his, of all possible, gin joints. Bogey drank after she left. It seemed to help him. Maybe it would help me, too. The fact that Rachel could still pack this kind of wallop annoyed the hell out of me. It was stupid and childish, really. Rachel and I had first met during summer break between my sophomore and junior years of college. She was from Middlebury, Vermont, and supposedly a distant cousin of Cheryl's, though no one could ascertain the exact relationship. That summer, the summer of all summers, Rachel stayed with Cheryl's family because Rachel's folks were going through a nasty divorce. We were introduced, and like I said before, it took some time for the bus to smack into me. Maybe that's what made it all the more potent when it did. We began to date. We doubled a lot with Lenny and Cheryl. The four of us spent every weekend at Lenny's summer house on the Jersey Shore. It was indeed a glorious summer, the kind of summer everyone should experience at least once in a lifetime. If this were a movie, we'd be queuing up the montage music. I went to Tufts University while Rachel was starting out at Boston College. First scene of the montage, well, they'd probably have us on a boat on the Charles, me paddling, Rachel holding a parasol, her smile tentative, then mocking. She'd splash me, and then I'd splash her, and then the boat would tip. It never happened, but you get the point. Next, maybe there would be a picnic scene on campus, a shot of us studying in the library, our bodies entwined on a couch, me staring mesmerized as Rachel reads from her textbook, her glasses on, absent-mindedly tucking a hair behind her ear. The montage would probably close on two bodies tussling under a white satin sheet, even though no college student uses satin sheets. Still, I'm thinking cinematic here. I was in love. During one Christmas break, we visited Rachel's grandmother, a card-carrying Yenta from the old school in a nursing home. The old woman took both our hands in hers and declared us beschert, which is a Yiddish word that means predestined or fated. So what happened? Our ending was not an uncommon one. We were young, I guess. During my senior year, Rachel decided that she wanted to spend a semester in Florence. I was 22, I got pissed off, and while she was away, I slept with another woman. A one-night stand with a featureless co-ed from Babson. It meant absolutely nothing. I understand that makes it no better, but maybe it should. I don't know. Anyway, someone at the party told someone else, and eventually it got back to Rachel. She called me from Italy and broke it off, just like that, which I saw as something of an overreaction. Like I said, we were young. At first, I was too proud, read, too stupid, to beg, and then when I started soaking in the repercussions, I called and wrote letters and sent flowers. Rachel never responded. It was over. We were done. I stood and stumbled to my desk. I fished out the key I had taped under the credenza and unlocked the bottom drawer. I lifted off the files and found my secret stash underneath. No, not drugs. The past. Rachel things. I found the familiar photo and pulled it into view. Lenny and Cheryl still have this picture in their den, which had, understandably enough, pissed off Monica to no end. It was a photograph of the four of us. Lenny, Cheryl, Rachel, and I, at a formal during my senior year. Rachel is wearing a spaghetti strap black dress, and the thought of the way it clung to her shoulders still takes my breath away. A long time ago. I've moved on, of course. Per my life plan, I went to medical school. I always knew that I wanted to be a doctor. Most doctors I know will tell you the same. It is rarely a decision you come to late. And I dated, too. I even had other one-night stands. Remember Zia? But, and this is going to sound pitiful, even after all these years, I never go through a day without thinking, at least fleetingly, about Rachel. Yes, I know that I've romanticized the romance, if you will, completely out of proportion. Had I not made that stupid blunder, I would probably not be living in some blissful alternative universe, still entwined on the couch with my beloved. As Lenny once pointed out in a moment of naked honesty, if my relationship with Rachel had been that great, it surely could have survived this most hackneyed of speed bumps. Am I saying that I never loved my wife? No. At least I think the answer is no. Monica was beautiful. Right away, beautiful. Nothing slow about the way her looks hit you. And passionate and surprising. She was also wealthy and glamorous. I tried not to compare. That is a terrible way to live your life, but I could not help but love Monica in my smaller, less bright post-Rachel world. Given time, the same might have happened had I stayed with Rachel, but that's using logic, and in matters of the heart, logic need not apply. Over the years, Cheryl grudgingly kept me informed on what Rachel was up to. Rachel, I'd learned, had gone into law enforcement and become a federal agent in Washington. I can't say I was totally surprised. 3 years ago, Cheryl told me that Rachel had gotten married to an older guy, a senior Fed. Even after all this time, Rachel and I had been broken up 11 years by then. I felt my insides cave in. I realized with a heavy thud just how badly I'd messed up. I'd always assumed somehow that Rachel and I were biding our time, living in some sort of suspended animation until we inevitably came to our senses and got back together. Now, she had married someone else. Cheryl saw my face and has never again spoken to me about Rachel. I stared at the picture and heard the familiar SUV pull up. No surprise there. I did not bother walking to the door. Lenny had a key. He never knocked anyway. He'd know where I was. put away the photograph as Lenny entered the room carrying two enormous, brightly clad paper cups. Lenny held up the Slurpees from 7-Eleven. Cherry or cola? Cherry. He handed it to me. I waited. Zia called Cheryl, he said in way of explanation. I had figured that. I don't want to talk about it, I said. Lenny hopped onto the couch. Me neither. He reached into his pocket and took out a thick sheaf of papers. The will and the final stuff on Monica's estate. Read it whenever. He picked up the remote control and began to flip. Don't you have any porno? No, sorry. Lenny shrugged and settled on a college basketball game on ESPN. We watched a few minutes in silence. I broke it. Why didn't you tell me Rachel was divorced? Lenny grimaced in pain and raised his palm as if stopping traffic. What? I said. Brain freeze. He wrote it out. I always drink these things too fast. Why didn't you tell me? I thought we weren't going to talk about it. I looked at him. It's not that simple, Mark. What's not? Rachel has been through some tough times. So have I said. Lenny watched the game a little too closely. What happened to her, Lenny? It's not my place. He shook his head. You haven't even seen her in, what, 15 years? 14, actually. Something like that. His eyes scanned the room and rested on a photograph of Monica and Tara. He looked away and sipped his Slurpee. Have to stop living in the past, my friend. We both settled back and pretended to watch the game. Stop living in the past, he'd said. I looked at the photograph of Tara and wondered if Lenny was talking about more than Rachel. Edgar Portman picked up the leather dog leash. He jingled the end. Bruno, his champion bull mastiff, clattered toward the sound at full speed. Bruno had won a best in breed at the Westminster Dog Show 6 years ago. Many believed that he had what it took to earn best in show. Edgar chose instead to retire Bruno. A show dog is never home. Edgar wanted Bruno with him. People disappointed Edgar. Dogs never. Bruno stuck out his tongue and wagged his tail. Edgar clipped the leash onto the collar. They would go for an hour. Edgar looked down at his desk. There on the shiny veneer sat a cardboard package, identical to the one he had received 18 months earlier. Bruno whimpered. Edgar wondered if it was a whimper of impatience or if he could sense his master's dread. Maybe both. Either way, Edgar needed air. The package from 18 months ago had undergone every possible forensic test. The police learned nothing. Edgar was relatively certain, based on that past experience, that the incompetence in law enforcement would find nothing again. 18 months ago, Mark had not listened to him. That mistake, Edgar hoped, would not be repeated. He started for the door. Bruno led the way. The air felt good. He stepped outside and sucked in a deep breath. It did not change his outlook, but it helped. Edgar and Bruno started down the familiar route, but something made Edgar veer to the right. The family plot. He saw it every day, so often that he no longer saw it, so to speak. He never visited the Stones. But today, suddenly, he felt drawn. Bruno, surprised by the deviation in his routine, grudgingly followed. Edgar stepped over the small fence. His leg throbbed. Old age. These walks were getting more difficult. He had begun using a walking stick a lot of the time. He had purchased one purportedly used by Dashiell Hammett during a TB stint. But for some reason, Edgar never took it with him when he was with Bruno. It felt wrong somehow. Bruno hesitated and then leapt the fence. They both stood in front of the two most recent headstones. Edgar tried not to ponder about life and death, about wealth and its relativity to happiness. That sort of lint-picking was best left to others. He realized now that he had probably not been a very good father. He had learned, however, from his father, who learned from his. And in the end, perhaps his aloofness had saved him. Had he loved his children fully, had he been deeply involved in their lives, he doubted that he could have survived their deaths. The dog began to whimper again. Edgar looked down at his companion, deep into his eyes. "Time to go, boy," he said softly. The front door of the house opened. Edgar turned and spotted his brother Carson rushing toward him. Edgar saw the look on his brother's face. "My God," Carson called out. "I assume you saw the package." "Yes, of course. Did you call Mark?" "No." "Good," Carson said. "It's a hoax. It has to be." Edgar did not reply. "You don't agree?" Carson said. "I don't know." "You can't possibly think that she's still alive." Edgar gave the leash a gentle tug. "Best to wait for the tests to come back," he said. "Then we'll know for certain." I like to work night hours. I always have. I am lucky in my career choice. I love my job. It is never a chore or drudgery or something I do simply to put food on the table. I disappear into my work. Like a troubled athlete, I forget everything when I'm playing my game. I enter the zone. I am at my best. This night, however, 3 nights after seeing Rachel, I was off duty. I sat alone in my den and flipped stations. I, like most males of our species, hit the remote too frequently. I can watch several hours of nothing. Last year, Lenny and Cheryl got me a DVD player, explaining to me that my VCR player was heading the way of the 8-track. I checked the clock on it now. A few minutes after 9. I could pop in a DVD and still get to bed by 11. I had just removed the rental DVD from its box and was about to stick it into the machine. They do not have a remote that does that yet, when I heard a dog bark. I rose. A new family had moved in 2 houses down. They had 4 or 5 young kids, something like that. Hard to say when a family has that many. They seemed to blur into one another. I had not introduced myself yet, but I had seen in their yard an Irish wolfhound who was approximately the size of a Ford Explorer. The bark, I believed, was his. I pushed the curtain aside. I looked out the window, and for some reason, a reason I cannot properly articulate, I was not surprised by what I saw. The woman stood in the exact same spot where I had seen her 18 months earlier. The long coat, the long hair, the hands in the pockets, all the same. I was afraid to let her out of my sight, but then again I did not want her to see me. I dropped to my knees and slid to the side of the window, super sleuth style. With my back and cheek pressed against the wall, I considered my options. First off, I was now not watching her. That meant she could leave and I wouldn't notice. Not good. I had to risk a look. That was first thing. I turned my head and sneaked a peek. Still there. The woman was still out front, but she had moved a few steps closer to my front door. I had no idea what that meant exactly. So now what? How about going to the door and confronting her? That seemed a pretty good move. If she ran, well, I guess that I would pursue. I risked another glimpse, just a quick head turn, and when I did, I realized that the woman was staring directly at my window. I fell back. Damn. She'd seen me. No way around it. My hands grabbed the bottom of the window, readying to open it, but she had already started hurrying up the block. Oh, no. Not this time. I was wearing surgical scrubs. Every doctor I know has a few pair for loungewear use, and I was barefoot. I sprinted to the door and threw it open. The woman was almost at the top of the block. When she saw me at the door, she stopped the hurry walk and broke into an all-out run. I gave chase. To hell with my feet. Part of me felt ridiculous. I am not the fastest fellow on two legs. I am probably not even the fastest on one leg. And here I was running down a strange woman because she was standing in front of my house. I don't know what I hoped to find here. The woman was probably taking a walk, and I had spooked her. She would probably call the police. I could see their reaction. Bad enough, I killed my own family and got away with it. Now I was chasing strange women around my neighborhood. I did not stop. The woman turned right onto Phelps Road. She had a big lead. I pumped my arms and willed my legs to pick up the pace. The pebbles on the sidewalk dug into the soles of my feet. I tried to stay on grass. She was out of view now, and I was out of shape. I had gone maybe 100 yards, and I could already hear the wheeze in my breath. My nose started running. I reached the end of my street and made the right. But there was no one. The road was long and straight and well enough lit. In other words, she should still be visible. For some dumb reason, I looked the other way, too, behind me, but the woman was not there either. I ran the route she'd taken. I looked down Morningside Drive, but there was no sign of her. The woman was gone. But how? She could not have been that fast. Carl Lewis was not that fast. I stopped, put my hands on my knees, sucked in some very necessary oxygen. Think. Okay, could she live in one of these houses? Perhaps. And if she did, so what? That meant that she was taking a walk in her own neighborhood. She had seen something that had struck her as curious. She stopped to take a look. Like she did 18 months ago. Okay, first off, we don't know if it was the same woman. So two women stopped in front of your house in the exact same spot and stood like statues? It was possible. Or maybe it was the same woman. Maybe she liked looking at houses. Maybe she was into architecture or something. Oh, yes, the ever-desirable architecture of the 70s suburban split level. And if her visit was totally innocent, why did she run away? I don't know, Mark, but maybe, and this is just a stab in the dark, maybe because some lunatic chased her? I shook the voice away and started running again, looking for I don't know what. But when I passed the Zucker's house, I came to a halt. Was that possible? The woman had simply disappeared. I had checked both exit roads. She was not on either one of them. So that meant A, she lived in one of the houses, B, she was hiding, or C, she had taken the Zucker path in the woods. When I was a kid, we sometimes used to cut through the Zucker's backyard. There was a path to the middle school fields. It was not easy to find, and old Lady Zucker really didn't like us going through her lawn. She would never say anything, but she would stand by the window, her beehive hair glazed like a Krispy Kreme, and glare us down. After a while, we stopped using the path and took the long way. I looked left and right. No sign of her. Could the woman know about the path? I sprinted into the blackness of the Zucker's backyard.